Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and here is one more clip from Eric Cantor's speech yesterday, the House Majority Leader. But is this statement fact or myth?
You know, in so many countries throughout history, children were largely consigned to the same station in life as their parents, but not here. Because here we've seen the son of a shoe man become the president of the United States.
But is that still true in meaningful numbers? We're going to catch up now with a story that ran over the holidays in the New York Times about the disheartening statistics that show that higher education, instead of evening the playing field, is often widening the gap between rich and poor today. Jason DeParle, senior writer at The Times who covers poverty and class issues, wrote the article that traced the path of three low-income, high-achieving students in Galveston, Texas, to college and back out. He joins me now along with Kristen Harris, director of college guidance at the Columbia Secondary School for Math, Science, and Engineering, and the chairman of the College Access Consortium of New York, to talk about her work with first-generation college-bound students here in the city and some of the barriers they face. So welcome back, Jason DeParle, and welcome to WNYC, Kristen Harris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, Jason, it's not surprising that more money equals more and better college, but how has the gap widened?
Yeah, it's not surprising that kids from affluent backgrounds get college degrees at higher rates than kids from low-income backgrounds. I mean, that would seem obvious. But what did surprise me is that the gap between them had grown over the past 25 years. It had grown despite all the efforts of equal opportunity programs and financial aid, and it had grown despite a modest narrowing in the racial gap. Blacks and whites are converging a little bit while rich and poor are growing farther apart.
So, for example, I'm going to give one very striking statistic that you had in your data chart. And listeners, if you want to see this, we have linked on our page to some of the data that accompanied Jason's story. You can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. And one of these data graphs shows that the share of students born to the top 25% of income households went up in the last generation among those who went to college from 36 to 54% completing college. And again, so these numbers don't scramble people's brains, this is in the households that make the top 25% of income in the country. A generation ago, just 36% of those people completed college. Now it's 54%. But among those born to the poorest fifth of parents, the increase was only from 5% of those families, students completing college, to 9%. So
right.
The gap actually widened. And
right. Both groups became more likely to finish college, but the gains were much more, much greater among the more affluent. So the gap between the two widened.
And Kristen Harris, does that ring true to you? And is it reflected in the students that you work with?
Absolutely. I think that the biggest challenge is the capacity of the college counselors in schools and the programs that these students are linked to. Students that are first gen and low income need more of a support network. Described in the article, you know, there were programs that the students were a part of, but the statistics show that students who are participating in more programs and who are connected to more adults who can support that college admissions and college application process, they prove to serve a little bit better, and they tend to go and matriculate and graduate. It's something that these students need extra support. These students need support through the summer before they go to college. They need support during that first year to make sure that they are able to go back. So I see that all the time, yes.
And so, listeners, we can take some calls on this. Were you the first in your family to attend college? Did you come from a low-income household? And what, besides money, did you need to succeed? Did you get the support from the college or from another source? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9222. 9692. And Jason, in your article, you traced the paths of these three low-income first-generation college students. One went to an elite school, Emory, in this case. One went to a state university in Texas, and one to a local community college. What are some of the things that tripped them up, and were they the same in each case?
You know, Brian, there's a whole variety of reasons, from academic background, preparation to, you know, to money, to family issues that can keep low-income kids from succeeding in college. I tried to focus on three kids who were clearly academically able to do the work. So this wasn't a case of, you know, these kids just couldn't cut it. As you said, one of them had got into Emory. But there were glitches in the financial aid that caused the kids to have to work long hours that hurt their ability to keep up with studies. There were issues with boyfriends who hadn't gone to college. There was a lack of family. You know, there was a vague sense of family wanting them to be there, but no financial support or guidance when they hit rough times. There was a kind of alienation on college from more affluent students. There were a whole host of reasons, and none of the three were able to finish college, although one is one's still in school, and the girl who went to Emory left after 3.5 years with more than $60,000 in debt.
So was there something fundamentally different about the experience in the community college than in the elite college?
It was more familiar. She stayed at home. It was cheaper. But the point to keep in mind is that the economic benefits of getting a college degree really only accrue to having a bachelor's degree. I mean, she was able to get a 2-year degree, but she's working in a restaurant to keep pace financially, economically, to have the professional opportunities that traditionally accrue to college. You need to get the 4-year degree, and she had initially intended to transfer, but by staying home, I think her ambition had kind of dissipated, and she didn't make it beyond the 2 years.
Kristen Harris, you told my producer that this is the area getting attention from philanthropists and the government, not just getting students into college, but getting them through college.
Right, to graduate.
Yes. What kinds of programs are there?
There are a number of programs through charter schools that support students to and through. I think KIPP is a pretty national example of how they support students while they're in school and supporting and navigating those trouble areas. There are a number of programs within the city and CBOs that support students throughout their high school and college career. You know, CBOs like the Oliver Program, Prep, TEEK, HEAF, SEO, Opportunity Network, ABC, those programs help students as they navigate that application process, but really support them through some of those trouble spots that they might encounter while they're in college, and support them to navigate that process and show them who they should be speaking to on campuses and reach out to those networks. And really show them how to advocate for themselves, because that's a big problem with our first-gen low-income students. They're not comfortable advocating for themselves.
Kristen Harris, director
of... Kristen really hit on an important point there. All three of the kids that I wrote about were very reluctant to go to teachers, deans. You know, Emory University is filled with programs aimed at helping low-income and minority students, and Helica, the girl I wrote about, was just very reluctant to seek any kind of help. And saw it as a sign of weakness, you know, an admission that that she couldn't handle things herself. And I think that was a problem for her.
Kristen Harris with us, Director of College Guidance at Columbia Secondary School for Math, Science, and Engineering, and Chairman of the College Access Consortium of New York, and New York Times reporter Jason DePaul, author of the book American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. And Brandy in Farmingdale, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us your story.
Well, you know, I am from a rural town in Northeast Texas, and I'm a first-generation high school graduate, in fact. And so I called in to say that, you know, I found many of the same problems completing my bachelor's degree. I had a great scholarship going in my first year, and lost it through, you know, missing deadlines and not understanding the importance of the bureaucracy. I failed to complete a FAFSA my first year and found myself out of school the following year.
What's the lesson from your experience?
You know, right now I'm trying to help a young cousin of mine join a four-year program as well. And, you know, I think what I learned was that I had, as a first-generation student, I had to ask for more help more often and earlier simply because I didn't have kind of the cultural background to understand some of the nuances of higher education, and I didn't have the mentorship, you know, in my home and, you know, public life.
Brandy, thank you. Kristen, you're nodding.
Yes.
Nodding in agreement?
I'm nodding too.
Yes. Yes. It's common issues for students. Early, applying strong, getting all of the information. I think one of the biggest challenges that stood out in the article were that these young ladies were academically soaring, they weren't getting all of the information. Many of them didn't apply to enough schools, so they had no options when it was all said and done. Another applied to a school because it was an easy application. So that was clear that she was doing this on her own. And our students really need to be supported through this process and understand that deadlines are real and they need to meet them. And if they don't, then severe consequences come. So,
Jason, why were you nodding?
Yeah, I'm sorry, nodding by phone. Well, Ann Helica, the girl who went to Emory, missed the deadline for financial aid her first year. In part, it was just her own fault. She missed the deadline. It was also she was slowed. Once she got a late start, but when she finally got on it, she couldn't find her father, and the financial aid forms needed information from both parents. She had no idea where her father was, so that was an additional complication. You know, it could have been worked out had she been in touch with Emory, but again, she didn't have the self-advocacy skills. She just kept trying, and she finally just showed up at Emory, having been admitted but not having financial aid, and they told her the only way she could start classes was to borrow $40,000 from a private bank. And, you know, this is a girl whose mother works at Walmart, makes less than $40,000 a year. She wanted an education so bad that she went and took out a $40,000 loan just to start school at Emory.
Erica in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Erica.
Hi. Hello, everyone. I'm calling. I was an EOS student here in New Jersey, and I also work on camp at a campus now as an admissions counselor. I also work at a nonprofit organization in Newark that helps does college prep classes for kids. And what I've found is that students who are coming from lower-income backgrounds and they're the first person in their families graduate, they just don't have that support system. A lot of parents, they don't know. And I heard you talk about how students are afraid to ask. Parents sometimes are even more afraid to ask because they don't want to admit that they don't know. So they leave it in the kids' hands to do it. Kids go to schools that they can't afford. Kids go to schools that out of state when they know they don't know that it's going to be difficult for them to get back and forth. Airfare, plane fare, bus fare. So they drop out because they can't afford to stay there. They can't afford to live on campus, so they drop out. They don't know what prerequisites they need to take. And what I found that's interesting is that a lot of the EOS programs here in New Jersey, or not just New Jersey, in the tri-state area, they're grant funded. And they don't have a lot of extra help in those programs that help those students. So the money isn't there to give these students even more help and advisement that they may need than other students. So I find that guidance counselors and teachers say, okay, well, we can get them in the school. But once they're there, they're kind of lost and they're left on their own.
And all three of you will agree that more funding is needed for these kinds of support programs. But Erica, short of that, given the resources that you are working with, what do you find is most effective to help the most students in these situations?
I feel that coming out, just letting students know that the resources are there and for them not to be afraid to do it. And also, I think it's a sense of community. You know, you have students that are going to schools for the first time. Some of them, this is their first time. They're leaving home, and they're afraid. And they're afraid to ask for help. And they're afraid to say, I don't know. I don't know how to fill out a financial aid form. I thought I was only supposed to do it once. But I have students who come from a fluid background, and they don't even know that. But their parents have the resources to hire financial aid people to do it, to hire people to help them with their interview. So I think that we have to have a sense of community, of not just, I see so many programs of getting kids into college, but we need something to say, hey, even no matter what schools you are, even if we're just the kids in Newark or the kids in Manhattan, come together no matter what schools you are and say, listen, what help do you need? Do you need help? How do you do this? How do you, you know, advocate for students? I see students who are about to get kicked out on probation. They have no idea what to do. And I think that sometimes counselors are so overwhelmed that they don't have time to sit with the student. They're meeting with hundreds of students during a week. I think also we just need, they need extra help in these EOF and HEOP programs to give them the help that they need.
Great call, Erica. Thank you very, very much. You should know that Kristen was nodding even more vigorously during your call than the previous one. And we're almost out of time, but Kristen, where do you take this? Jason raised these issues for more people to know about in his New York Times article. We've been hearing from some of our callers like Erica. What happens next?
I think the biggest takeaway is that we need to support our students. How we do that with limited resources and limited capacity is partnering with colleges, partnering with CBOs and community-based organizations who are doing this college access work. That's a lot of what I do at Columbia Secondary. I know I can't do it all by myself, and I don't try, but I know I have the resources through my networks, and that's what CACNY does, the College Access Consortium of New York. We work and bring together college access professionals so that they can capacity build and they can build their resources and partner and network so that they can serve the most students in the best way possible.
Jason DePaul, 30 seconds left. How important is the fact that more colleges are moving away from need-blind admissions?
Yeah, let me answer your question this way. I wouldn't view this only as an education story. I think this is a product of the growing inequality that we're seeing in society on so many fronts. The affluent are getting more so. There's a bigger gap between the rich and the poor. They're living in different neighborhoods. There's kids are growing up increasingly in different kinds of family structure with single mothers predominating at the bottom and two-parent families at the top. The education system was supposed to be the equalizer, as you said at the beginning. Given the growing inequality, it's sort of infiltrated into the education system, and rather than leveling and challenging inequality, I think it may be reproducing it.
Jason DePaul, New York Times correspondent and author of the book American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare, and Kristen Harris, Director of College Guidance at Columbia Secondary School for Math, Science, and Engineering, and Chairman of the College Access Consortium of New York. Thank you both so much for a really important discussion.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up next, and you can start calling now, your stories of choosing between alternative medicine and your doctor's advice. 212-433-WNYC. Stay with us.